Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Iram Khan of the University of Illinois Chicago and Dr. Jonathan Morera of Northwestern University to explore the impacts of structural racism on acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, outcomes for underserved communities and ethnically diverse patients in the Chicago area. We discuss the novel and eye-opening research from Dr. Khan and her team, as well as possible solutions to barriers to care and access issues for ethnically diverse patients. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part discussion. All right, so I am here with Dr. Iram Khan and Dr. Jonathan Morera. It's a pleasure to host you both on Explore Cell Therapy. Today, we're talking about structural racism, which is a very important issue in the United States and really globally, but certainly in our healthcare system. So, Dr. Khan, I would love to start out by discussing your recent research study on structural racism and AML outcomes in more detail. Can you tell me a little bit about your research, how it started, overall goals for this study?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me here today. So the research that that we undertook, and this is really a Chicago-wide effort where all the institutions kind of pull together their data to really sort of get a little bit of a sense of real-world role that structural factors play in leukemia outcomes. And I think it was largely inspired by kind of early looks at data where we were having some other collaborative studies and looking at various predictors of leukemia outcome, and found that race was really standing out. And that kind of led us to dig a little bit deeper about what does that really mean? And is there a way to quantify that? I think we certainly know from much larger data sets than ours that race has over many years been a negative predictor of outcome in acute myeloid leukemia, but we wanted to really put it in the context of other clinically validated markers of prognosis and really see that on its own, is it bringing something to a patient's outcome, and try and statistically show that as a way to kind of start the conversation and try and understand and really address some of the bases of these disparities.
Dr. Khan, I would say it's pretty novel to try to capture structural racism quantitatively as such a complex concept. Can you talk a little bit about how you went about defining structural racism for this study and how you constituted it as a variable, sort of the strengths and limitations of your approach?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's definitely a point of caution here, that we used surrogate variables, surrogates at the neighborhood level, because this is a retrospective study, which means, you know, we went back to patient starts and we were limited to what we could get using that type of research. And so what we did was we used census tracts. Census tract has been approximated in public health research as a better marker of neighborhood level conditions compared to, let's say, zip code, which you traditionally see in more cancer research that's looking at socioeconomic status. So this is a much smaller area and has been shown to more tightly correlate with neighborhood. So we use census tract measures. So using each individual patient's census tract, based on where they were living at the time of diagnosis, we collected data from, you know, publicly available data sets regarding those census tracts, and computed these three variables of census tract disadvantage, census tract affluence, and census tract segregation. And these looked at slightly different aspects of structural racism, in the sense that they kind of encompass household income, female-headed households, level of college education in the census tract. So a few different ways to look at it, and then also the level of segregation in that census tract. And so using these three, we kind of came up with this composite variable. This had been previously done by our collaborator, Dr. Rauscher, in the breast cancer research realm. And so we basically kind of co-opted this methodology into the leukemia research. But absolutely, it's by no means a comprehensive way to interrogate this very broad question. It's really just, you know, saying, does where you live, which, you know, in turn is really reflective of a number of things in terms of access to healthcare, opportunities, lifestyle, etc. Does that independently add to your outcome if you are a patient with acute myeloid leukemia?
Yeah, wonderful. So what were some of the key findings that came out of that work?
So I think we kind of went in knowing that we do suspect that where a patient's coming from does play a role in how they do with leukemia. But I think we were surprised, or I know we were surprised, by the extent to which this variable that we crafted was able to negate the disparity between Black and white patients with AML. So starting out, we knew that Black patients in our cohort, so just looking at our 822 patients in the Chicago area, we knew that Black patients were doing worse than white patients and had a higher risk of death compared to their white counterparts. But could we, to some extent, reduce that disparity by accounting for this structural racism variable we created, which is based on where they lived? And it really fully corrected the disparity, which means, you know, you are equally likely to survive the leukemia if you were from the same census tract. So I think that just kind of shone a light on the fact that really there's a lot of modifiable risk factors in there. And by no means is this a simple variable to kind of address. It can encompass a lot of things. It can encompass perhaps where you live influences the type of leukemia you develop, right? Maybe it's leading to a series of mutations over years that lead to a more resistant leukemia. Could it be that perhaps you weren't seeing a doctor as regularly just because of the nature of your work or your insurance? And so perhaps changes in your blood count weren't captured early, where perhaps it could have been picked up before it became, you know, a pre-existing MDS became a full-blown AML. Or could it just be that by the time you showed up to the doctor, you had a few other problems, you had kidney problems, you had heart problems, things that perhaps reflected, insufficient access to primary care. And now suddenly we cannot optimally treat the leukemia because there's all these other concurrent conditions. So, you know, the possibilities are multifold. I think we were just surprised at the numerically how, you know, this one variable could correct a lot of things, because we looked at other variables like the mutation types in your leukemia, which is, you know, for us like bread and butter, how we kind of, you know, stratify patients. And those variables didn't fix the disparity. And neither did just comorbidities alone. So clearly there's something more, and we need to understand what that is.
Right. Now, Dr. Marrera, I'd love to hear your reactions to this work as well.
One of the findings that this paper really helped shed a light on, as Dr. Khan was mentioning, is crystallizing what many of us in the field have noticed, right, with regards to our own patient outcomes. And that's the beauty and the power of this type of research and this type of work, is that it's applying this objective data and demonstrating with this information that we do have disparate outcomes in these populations, and that there's a myriad of layers and barriers to getting our patients to, have a great outcome from induction chemotherapy consolidation, and then moving on to other options, including hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. As a transplant physician in Chicago, we certainly have a very diverse, a broad spectrum of patients that we see, many of whom come from very affluent backgrounds, resource-rich backgrounds, but many of our patients as well who come from historically marginalized communities on the south sides, the west sides of Chicago, and all throughout the city. And we see a myriad of barriers that they have that doesn't allow them to either reach a stem cell transplant to begin with or have worse outcomes following that. So I think that's what was really impactful about Dr. Khan's groundbreaking work, especially within the context of a city that has historically been one of the most segregated in the United States for about a century now.
I think that perhaps Chicago almost provided a really important or relevant kind of microcosm to really interrogate the racism question, because unfortunately there's a lot of that, in this city.
Right. UIC actually, I think, has extensive data on outcomes in a multitude of solid tumors, showing data on the ward level in Chicago. So the wards are the administrative divisions of the city. And you can draw out a very stark map with regards to outcomes for these patients with breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer, and kind of tune it to where these patients live within the city of Chicago. And so I think Dr. Khan's work adds on to that dearth of data. It really does demonstrate that, there is an institutional process that is hindering equitable, not just access to care, but equitable outcomes when we do apply our standards of care to these patient populations.
And I think something, you're absolutely right. And I'll add prostate cancer to that list, because that's one where there's, it's actually really stark. And I think, the important thing with the fact that we wanted to look at AML was that it's a disease compared to some of these others where, this is not a disease where, early detection and screening or anything sort of necessarily play in. And so we kind of think of all patients sort of being born equal when they show up to the hospital with this acute sort of kind of emergent diagnosis. And so you would think that, here on things are pretty, everybody's kind of starting off at the same level, but clearly there are differences. And so trying to understand in sort of the unique treatment paradigm of AML, where, there's different types of treatment, there's high intensity, low intensity, transplant, no transplant, it's a little bit different, and there's no screening. So what are really the points at which the curves start to splay in this particular disease? And I think we're just kind of beginning to chip away at that.
Right. And to add on to that, I think Dr. Khan illustrated the fact that Chicago presents a very unique microcosm. I'm not privy to the historical details that shaped, cities across the country, be it New York or Miami or Boston or Kansas City or Los Angeles or Houston, Texas. But I, being a native Chicagoan, I'm a bit more familiar with the historical forces that really shaped our city into what it is today. And I think this very Chicago-centric research really helps add to the body of data that does exist, where we do have, in the realm of stem cell transplantation, papers that have been published over several years ago demonstrating disparate outcomes, specifically looking at the factor of race. Right. So I think this helps accentuate it and helps take us out of this construct where we think of, sometimes people, despite our knowledge to the contrary, think of race as a biological construct, where it's a sociocultural, a sociopolitical construct. And I think this work really helps provide a bit more clarity as to what sociopolitical or socioeconomic factors are really shaping, resources in cities, distance to transplant centers or tertiary or quaternary care centers, insurance access, and a whole host of other factors that maybe we haven't really thought too well. Access to healthy foods, structural violence, and actual, physical violence that people face, and how that impacts all these other types of stress factors. So I think that's what really is very powerful about this research.
Yes, such important work, really. And I am curious, you each brought up specific points about why AML and why Chicago. And I would just love to hear your perspectives of, do you see similar things, or do you think you would find similar things in other diagnoses that are potentially indicated as an option for stem cell transplantation, and also what differences might you see in other parts of the country, whether they be other urban settings or maybe rural settings even? Are there different barriers that kind of come into play there?
I'll let Jonathan take the transplant.
Sure. So I think this is a really important question, right? And if I think we're making the argument that there are, it's more than just biological factors of the disease that are adversely impacting outcomes in these different communities, then I think it's reasonable to assume that we might see a similar pattern emerge when we're thinking of patients that we transplant for rare T cell lymphomas, or patients who suffer from myeloproliferative neoplasms, or a whole range of other types of hematologic malignancies for which we need to pursue, say, an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. What role do other factors that maybe we haven't really given too much thought to, such as the microbiome? Shape, especially because the microbiome plays such a pivotal role in immune reconstitution. How is that shaped by individual factors? How is that shaped by the environment in which we live in? There's certainly data showing that the microbiome is shaped by some environmental factors in urban centers that has been published outside of the realm of stem cell transplantation. But knowing how important it is to have a well-reconstituted and well-developed immune system from the donor, and that plays a critical role in alloreactivity for these patients. Well, how is it shaped if people don't have access to nutritious food? How is it shaped if they live close to a industrial center that is spewing out pollution that's in the groundwater, or that's in the soil, or that ultimately, is in the air that the residents are breathing? And then when you think of challenges that are faced in different parts of the country, Chicago has a very diverse population, there's many urban centers and rural communities across the country that might have diverse backgrounds as well. But the patients, the people that live in a city like Houston, Texas, or along the Rio Grande, the Rio Grande River Valley, or people who live in rural parts of Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia or New Mexico, there's going to be compounded issues and barriers that they might face, whether those be access to tertiary or quaternary centers. As we alluded to before, Chicago is fortunate to have several transplant centers and several highly specialized academic institutions. But there are some states in the country where there aren't any, or there are areas of the country where access to transportation is really at a loss. And so there's been data published, distance to transplant centers having an adverse impact on outcomes for hematopoietic stem cell transplant recipients. But likewise, how does that work out when these communities are facing a myriad of other challenges, right? So I think that I would be surprised to find that we didn't observe similar phenomenon when looking at patients with MPNs, when looking at patients with myeloma, when looking at patients with Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Dr. Khan, do you have any plans currently to expand this research at all beyond AML or potentially to other areas of the country?
So at this point in time, I think we are trying, I think we want to take a deeper dive into the data set that we have built with our colleagues. And I think, it's been really, really great for us because, we have very senior leukemia investigators, and all five academic centers that, you know, have worked on this project, and they all sort of are trying to leverage their individual, you know, science and resources that they have at their institutions to interrogate various aspects of this. For example, looking at, you know, air pollutants and how that can play into the biology of the disease, and a little bit about a patient's individual experience kind of in a prospective setting moving forward from the time of diagnosis, and kind of serially interviewing them through questionnaires as well as face-to-face interviews to kind of try and explore some of the patient experiences as they navigate the various decision points in their disease, the various settings, inpatient and outpatient, and those transitions, and the discussion around stem cell transplant and where things sometimes don't go through. And I think just kind of hearkening back a little bit to what Dr. Mira brought up about geographic distance to transplant center being linked to outcomes, I think that a point that I really stood out to us and was a little bit, sobering, I would say, is that there was still a very major black-white disparity in transplant for patients with AML, which is one of the commonest diagnoses for patients undergoing stem cell transplant. And so seeing that despite, you know, so many efforts to kind of, you know, liberalize HLA matching, use haploidentical donors, use cords, all these alternate donor sources that we've been tapping into, and, you know, this whole mantra that everybody should have theoretically a donor. I'll let Dr. Mira address that one a little bit more, but, importantly, kind of highlighting that clearly that's not enough. And is it HLA barriers? Is it non-HLA barriers? So we're trying to dig a little bit into our data to see, where did the problem arise where a transplant eligible by disease criteria, disease and age criteria patient didn't get a transplant. So I think those are some of the areas we're focusing on right now. I think it will be wonderful to see other centers kind of doing this and mirroring. At this point in time, I don't have any concrete plans to look further afield right now.
Thank you. Dr. Marrera, I'd love to sort of hear your thoughts on what Dr. Khan was just saying, particularly about HLA versus non-HLA barriers, sort of where we are in that discussion for transplant as a treatment option. And obviously, there is a lot more research that needs to go into that area to fully understand the barriers for these patients. So would love to hear your thoughts.
So we've made tremendous progress with regards to broadening out, or for lack of a better phrase, democratizing the process of finding suitable donors for patients, whether it's the usage of mismatched MUDs or matched unrelated donors, rather, or using haploidentical stem cell donors, umbilical cord donors. And so I think, if I'm not mistaken, we can probably secure a donor for around 90% of patients potentially. And that's of tremendous benefit. And again, maybe my data is a little bit off or optimistic, but I think that's where the data seems to stand when we're expanding to these alternative donor sets. When it comes to these non-HLA barriers to transplant, I think this is a really critical juncture. We might have, each institution varies with regards to the criteria that they're looking at in order to determine if somebody is an eligible donor. And many of them might circle around the fact, what kind of social support does somebody have? What kind of financial support do they have? Are they able to afford the medications that are necessary to be taken? What kind of transportation barriers or challenges do they face? Especially prevalent in the setting of a pandemic where, you know, people might feel understandably anxious or concerned about having a patient getting on public transportation when they're immunocompromised. And one of the challenges that emerges as we're considering patients for transplant is being able to broaden out our horizons and our criteria for who might be an eligible patient, and being a bit more flexible, right, with regards to thinking of that. So, you know, with regards to transportation issues or challenges, you know, if somebody lives fairly far away from a transplant center, that's understandably concerning, because if they develop acute GVHD or if they develop an infectious complication, you justifiably worry about them going to a center close to home that may not have the requisite expertise or experience to take care of an allogeneic stem cell transplant recipient. And so that might give many transplant centers a bit of pause and saying, well, is this going to be a good compatible fit for someone? Or, you know, they live quite far away. They don't have someone that can drive them to and from. Can they come on a weekly basis or several, a couple of times a week if they need transfusion support? There are simple solutions that we could potentially envision in those domains that we could potentially alleviate or minimize that barrier. Perhaps someone has linguistic barriers, right? And that always becomes a concern. And that's not a contraindication by any stretch of the imagination at our institution or I'm sure any others. But that might give some pause or some concern to well-meaning stakeholders in saying, well, how are we going to make sure that someone's adherent to this? Right? Because even though we might have access to interpreters, sometimes there are cultural nuances that are kind of lacking. So I think things that we can do is as we've made the argument in other domains of issues of health inequities, prioritizing a more diverse workforce. And that certainly should include physicians and transplant physicians, but it should also include nurse practitioners, nurses, social workers, physical therapists, even financial counselors in the cancer center that are going to be bicultural or bilingual or multilingual. And that could help navigate some of the
too, because I think diet, especially, I'll add nutritionists to your list.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Nutritionists. Actually, that's a great point, Dr. Khan, because there might be some nuances where having that cultural competency to be aware of, what is the diet of somebody that comes from, whether it's sub-Saharan Africa or the Caribbean or South Asia or Southeast Asia. What are the misperceptions that we might bring to the table when we're taking care of these patients and what kind of support do they have? And really, even what does support look like? Maybe somebody has a very extensive family, and even if their health literacy is quite low, or maybe quite low, there might be a will and a determination and an openness to kind of learn these kinds of things, helping utilize these assets. When we look at, for example, something that comes to mind amongst immigrant populations, for example, is the Latino maternal paradox, right? Where you look at infant mortality rates amongst the children of Latin American immigrants. And those actually seem to be outliers relative to where they are from a socioeconomic level. And I think that's where they rely on this very extensive network, formal and informal network of extended family members or community members to help minimize the risk of infant mortality in these populations. And interestingly enough, and again, I'm not, well-versed in this data, but just hearing about this and in other aspects of health inequity, sometimes that infant mortality benefit does diminish with subsequent generations as people are become acclimated and growing up in this country. So there is something to be said about some of those cultural assets and cultural values that might translate into other areas of medicine. Having practitioners and healthcare professionals that come from diverse cultural and racial and ethnic backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds, and really employing low-cost but flexible and creative solutions to some of the barriers that these patients face. I mean, can you create, whether a rideshare or a taxi pool, for example, if you're worried about your patient getting on public transportation, can cancer centers set up a fund where they have a pool of money? And I think many of these solutions are probably already being addressed on a daily basis, but if we can be more forthright and be more dedicated in supporting this, and so this doesn't have to be a second thought. It's like we secured these vouchers for, X number of months for this patient. And so that doesn't have to be a process that you always have to engage a social worker that might have a multitude of other issues that are set up. Maybe this is part of their pre-transplant package and saying, all right, this is going to be a barrier that we identify. Let's set aside that pool of money right now so we don't have to worry about that. So those are just simple examples of what we can do. Even if you're thinking of healthy and nutritious food sources, right? Can you pair up with local food banks or cooperatives or urban or community gardens where we might be able to provide some sort of and nutritious, low-cost options for nutritional sources for patients and their caregivers as well, right? So we can make sure that that's something that they don't have to necessarily face. And sometimes that task is a little bit challenging because Dr. Khan and I are physicians. We're not, you know, we're not social workers. We're not sociologists. We're not intricately familiar with the multitude of factors that layer on to contribute to adverse outcomes in our patients. Nor are we privy to many of these solutions, right? But these are some of the things that we can engage relevant stakeholders in these communities.
And I think I'll add one thing, Jonathan, that was like really well put, but you know, in terms of caregiver support, I think that, you know, especially for patients who may not have, you know, private insurance that sometimes provides a lot of these ancillary services that that really help to make a smooth transition, either following leukemia treatment or following transplant treatment, you know, or even as they're getting onboarding with the whole transplant process, really addressing very concretely the issue of, you know, caregiver and not making that an exclusion, you know, a de facto exclusion criteria, but really trying to leverage the patients, you know, and a lot of communities do have a very strong family support system, as you mentioned, and others don't, and trying to understand how we can maximize caregiver support in terms of, you know, helping them with their, you know, a lot of times they have problems getting leave from work, their professions, their children, you know, all sort of the realities of life. And they may have jobs that don't have the kind of flexibility that perhaps higher paying jobs do. And so to really, you know, it, as we think of like a pot of resources and how to allocate it, I think putting that money up front and really providing that buffer that the caregivers need to be effective caregivers, the education at a cultural level, and the real pragmatic support that they need for the time that they need it, I think would go a long way into preventing a lot of early post-transplant complications, and also even earlier than that, prevent us from thinking patients are good, you know, transplant or eligible transplant candidates. And then the one other thing, it would be housing. I think we've one of our most challenging populations are the patients that are, you know, sort of nursing home residents or undomiciled, and, you know, trying to divert some resources into really providing low cost housing options that we, and I don't know, Dr. Marrera, how it is there at Northwestern, but, you know, we have like this one option, and, you know, we're lucky that the Illinois Medical District has a subsidized apartment that we can, you know, with our social workers book, and really for a very negligible amount of money, patients are able to stay there, provided they have a caregiver. They have to have that caregiver, and, you know, they can stay there for at least the first month. So that's, you know, one of our sort of how we approach the problem of patients who are coming from 3 hours away or, you know, from areas where we, again, same thing, we worry about the distance to the transplant center. So, you know, if we can think more at a much broader level at solutions like that, where we can partner, like you said, with people who have more sort of expertise and lay of the land in terms of trying to address these issues that often are barriers to transplant and then in affect transplant outcome.
Thanks so much for joining us today, and be sure to come back again for the second half of this episode, where our guests take a closer look at this work in relation to barriers to care, as well as approaches to addressing those barriers.